I might make a quick observation. One of the things that the speakers haven't touched upon is the very, well, or rather, very tangentially, the inefficiency of capitalism. And I've got two examples from my own life about the way that capitalism is such an inefficient system, and it relates to my two kids, both adults now, and they've both studied, they both achieved university qualifications and such like. But my eldest son, my youngest son, was studying to be a for hotel management, postgraduate in hotel management, and this was, he just qualified just as the 2008-2009 financial crisis struck, and of course all of the people that would normally recruit him were going to close down their recruitment programs. My eldest son recently did an open university course in geology, and just as he graduated, the crash occurred where many people were made redundant, including geologists from the North Sea oil industry and oil industry in general. So of course there was no work available for him. So we've got two young men who've tried the best to skill themselves up, and at certain cycles of capitalism, it turns out to be completely pointless. Now, I'm not saying it because, well, I'm saying it because I've got knowledge. But this is what affects people all the time. Capitalism is an anarchic system that doesn't allow us to act as proper human beings. It's an irrational system, and that's one of the main issues of that we have with it. Anyway, right, I seem to have been rambling on, and anybody in the speaking queue.
Should I respond briefly to that, Steve?
Please.
Now, just to say, you talked about that there was sort of no discussion of in the course of what Bill and I had to say.
Sorry, it wasn't a criticism.
No, it's all right. No, of the inefficiencies of capitalism. Well, I thought I did sort of refer to them obliquely, at least, in talking about that television program where vast resources were being expended to try and catch people who, instead of spending £10 on their underground fare, were, say, trying to get away with spending £5. Vast resources, vast people power, etc. Lots of people being employed to do work which is, even in the context of capitalism, is pretty useless and inefficient. And as I say, that sort of multiplies itself many millions of times over in the system as a whole. So yes, I absolutely agree with you. The inefficiencies of the market system are absolutely legion and affect everyone at various stages of their life.
Yeah, sorry, I did say right. I was slack mouthed. Let's put it that way. But what I wanted to draw attention to was the cyclical disruptions that can occur in capitalism. What you're talking about is everyday waste. Yet you've got this cyclical problem in capitalism that messes people's lives up. And anyway, so the tech Mike Foster, please.
Thank you. Yeah, and I really enjoyed both talks. A lot to think about, and I think that both talks complemented each other well. Something popped into my head from what Bill was saying about what a day is. You know, one of those things that's, you know, sort of so obvious we don't sort of tend to think about it. You know, it's just always there, and it's good to be sort of pointed out what a day is, and that got me thinking that as we get older, you know, the days and the years seem to pass much quicker. At least they do for me. I think that's a sort of a general phenomenon. Whereas when we're when we're younger, when we're children, you know, the 6 weeks school holiday seemed like a lifetime, and you know, every day was, you know, seemed you know, much more sort of full of events. And I think that's because everything's sort of new, and you're still sort of discovering the world when you're younger. And of course, as you get older, you get ground down by the routines and, you know, the making sure there's always enough money, making sure you're on time for work, you know, all of those things which drag down our lives. And I suppose it's a blessing in a way that somehow that's connected with time seeming to speed up. So there seems to be less of the drudgery, and of course not enough time for free time. So yeah, I think that way that time seems to speed up, you know, that jumps into my head as what Bill said. Thanks. Yeah, really enjoyed both talks. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, I'll take Paul next, and if the speakers wish to respond, please just jump in. So Paul Bennett, please.
Okay, yeah. I recently listened to a podcast on the Guardian Science Weekly, and that dealt with the difference between what they called morning larks and night owls. That's to say, people who feel more awake and want to work more sort of in the mornings, and other people who feel more awake and alive and want to work more in the evenings and late at night. And I think one of the things they said was that there's some kind of genetic background to that, not a simple, one simple gene determines it, but some kind of genetic background. And one thing that occurred to me is that capitalism doesn't really allow people to work differently in that kind of way, that given what a day is under capitalism, then you really have to be essential, but for the most part, morning larks having to start working early in the morning, 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock or even earlier, whereas perhaps a socialist society maybe would be able to accommodate both kinds of people and those who are in between the two as well. But, okay, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Would either of you like to comment?
I think that there's brings up something I don't think I touched on as directly as I could have, but that very much that the imposition of time is a part of labour discipline and of control. And I was just looking it up quickly. There's a Alan Plater radio play called "Only a Matter of Time," in which he explores how they had to, the standardisation of the railway timetables, because each town at one point had its own time zone. You know, midday in Bristol would have been the time when the sun was at the zenith, and that would have been different slightly by a couple of minutes by the midday in London. But of course, what's happened is, in order to run an efficient railway system, everyone had to use London time. And then there is this sort of like idea of the imposition of time. And I think I remember being at an exhibition about photographs from the British Empire, and there was a town centre in Pakistan where the town clock dominated the town. Of course, the creation of these clocks in societies that previously had no concept of time in this rigidly organised fashion was a way of imposing control. I don't know how, nuclear power plants, people will have to work and work their shifts at exactly the right time. And if we're going to have to take over the nuclear power plants, you know, whether we want to or not, because they'll still be there on the morrow of the revolution. But I think that socialism could bring in a very different relationship to time, I think, is the point that I was struggling towards.
Okay, thank you. Comrade O'Neill.
Hi. First of all, thanks to Bill and Howard for the talks. Thank you. Enjoyed them. Really just a question to either speaker. I guess May Day is also a time of reflection in terms of, like, if you like, the balance sheet of, you know, the working class, where it is politically, not necessarily socialists, but just even as trade unionists. And I guess I'm just wondering if either of the speakers or anybody else in the meeting has any thoughts on where we're at in 2021 in comparison to, I don't know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. You know, is it brighter? Is it not so bright? You know, we recently had the union drive at Amazon in Alabama. They lost, you know, they lost the vote because that's what happens. But the very fact that they had that union fight in itself was carries a significance, and I don't think it's going to go away. You know, the kind of desire for unionization for Amazon workers and other, you know, workers, just you know, wonder if any thoughts on, you know, what's going on, what possibly, you know, maybe I'm a futurology in terms of the next couple of years rather than what's going to happen 50 years. Thank you.
Impossible question, Darren, really. There's so many different things going on, in so many different parts of the world, a lot of which we no doubt don't know about. So it's very hard to sort of formulate an overall picture of whether our position, our ideas are sort of, you know, closer to being accepted or further away. In certain terms, you know, we're further away. I mean, you know, the party's peak, for example, in terms of membership, was immediately after the Second World War. We're significantly down on that. But does that mean the ideas we're putting across are further away from being accepted, from being put into effect? Very, very hard to know. And, I mean, workers, if the Amazon workers do finally get the rights within capitalism they've been looking for, will that mean that those workers have a sort of more advanced political consciousness? Not sure about it. It really is a sort of fraught question, and one I don't think anyone can answer with any kind of certainty. Sorry about that.
Bill, do you want to come in?
I take an even bleaker view. I mean, certainly the one ray of light from the Alabama situation was that the Biden administration said that they might change the rules over these sorts of union drives because they felt that it was one-sided. And it's really weird that a lifelong political hack like Biden has put a bust of Cesar Chavez, who's a union bureaucrat, but in his office. So I don't know quite what that's, if that's just tokenism signaling or if that is some sort of heartfelt connection to other shady union bosses. But over here at the present moment, the situation is that with all the government mired in deep amounts of corruption, the support for them is going up. And the rather terrifying reports from France that a lot of people, when opinion polled, supported the coup threat from the retired generals. It's looking reasonably bleak. But on the other hand, things like Bolivia, they saw off the authoritarian threat, and saw off Trump, I suppose. So that there is some sort of element of popular movements are out there, but I don't know if there's anything particularly for us. I think that nationalist sentiment seems to be dominating, presumably as a problem of the scarcity that the couple of recent crises have imposed on everyone.
Do you want to come back, Darren?
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Howard.
Can I just say, so much depends on the lens through which you view things, and there are lots of different lenses around for you to pick up and view things through. Really sort of tricky, impossible question to answer, certainly with any kind of certainty or precision.
Sorry, Steve, can I just say one brief thing? Yeah, because
go please.
You know, I obviously totally understand where both Howard and Bill are coming from. But, you know, being a contrary bugger like I am, you know, I think, you know, I remember, you know, like, this is an old discussion and other people are aware of it. But, you know, there was members of this party who wanted to jettison words like socialism and capitalism because these words put people off. People didn't want to talk about it. And then this thing called the anti-capitalist movement, in whatever form you want to talk about it, you know, suddenly appeared from seemingly from nowhere. Like in like 1999, 2000. And I would say the same things maybe happen about class, you know? The way people talk about working class, you know, capitalist class, you know. So I totally understand why Edward and Bill have, you know, the glass is half empty. But, you know, I'm just being contrary. You know, the fact that certain terminology is no longer taboo, even if it's not necessarily what people are saying, think it's what we argue. The very fact that you could actually possibly engage in a conversation now with people about class, about capitalism, about socialism, things like that, well, that's kind of a positive. I think the more people maybe think in those terms, and I accept what Bill was saying about how post-consciousness, if you want to use that old term, is prevalent amongst the working class, that can shift, and it can shift a lot quicker than any of us can ever anticipate. The hacks amongst us, because we've already seen it with like the whole capitalism, anti-capitalism thing 20 years ago. Thank you.
And we've also recently got this thing about, which is a bit of a surprise to me, the democratic socialists of America. So it's ceased to be a dirty word in even in the United States, which astounds me. If I might just to take chair's privilege, but if I could just draw people's attention to, we were talking earlier about days and stuff, and the day is a social thing as well, and what we've lost in recent times in the trade union struggle is the recognition of Sunday working. It used to be the case that Sunday working was unusual. It was paid at double time. I'll bet you that the workers in Asda or Tesco or where have you are not getting double time. And what this shows is that capitalism will encroach on family time. It will encroach on private time, and it's forever seeking to take more and more control of our lives. Paddy next, please.
Well, actually, I thought the conversation moved on, but you've just taken it back there, Steve. So what I've got to say is kind of relevant. I remember reading a couple of years ago, and I've just actually found a reference for this. So I've put it on the useful links if anybody's interested. Bill might be interested in this. There's quite a lot of evidence that until about the middle of the 17th century, people in northern European countries had what's called a bimodal or biphasal sleep pattern. What they would do is they would sleep for 4 hours, they'd get up and do a few hours' work, and then they'd sleep for another 4 hours. And some people apparently still do this. But we've completely forgotten this. So we all assume that, you know, you need your average 8 hours every night. And apparently this wasn't the norm in Northern Europe. It just kind of underlines how capitalism has, you think capitalism's regulated our life patterns, our sleep patterns. It's even worse than that. There was a psychiatrist did an experiment in the 1990s where he had a group of people, a bit like the cave experiment, but this was with light. And so these people were left in darkness for 14 hours every day instead of the sort of more typical 8 hours. And he did that for a month. What they'd all done by the end of that month was they developed a bimodal sleep pattern. So they were getting so much darkness and so little light that they were spontaneously breaking into this bimodal sleep pattern. And as I say, the fact that it's quite historically documented, this. And this bimodal pattern starts to disappear in Northern Europe around the late 17th century. So this is kind of when capitalism's getting going. And the article says it's thought to have started there and then filtered down to the rest of Western society over the next 200 years. So there we are. That's just a point of information.
Thanks very much, Paddy.
Can we very quickly, which I have heard this before, that more broadly, that we seem to have evolved to have siestas. that there is some evidence that a midday sleep is supposed to be better for us than just getting up and ploughing on. I think that is very interesting what Paddy says about the way that sleep and days have changed according to the way we've lived our lives. I'll certainly have to follow that link up.
I'm glad that you said ploughing on, because I was going to add that the siesta is partly because draft animals refuse to work in the middle of the day. So you have to get them out at 5 o'clock in summer. You need to get them out at 5 o'clock in the morning, work for 3 or 4 hours, then put them in a field, and then you go for a sleep, and then you get them out later on. I've had experience of this myself. It would never have occurred to me not done it. I'll take Freddie next. I beg your pardon, I'll take Paul. Comrade Edwards first, please.
Hi there. Cheers, Steve. Yeah, thanks, Howard and Bill. Very good. I liked the way that worked in there. That was very interesting. Just, afternoon naps, God, where would we be without them, eh? Mediterranean systems and all the rest of it. It's certainly a far more civilised way of this, getting up at 6 in the morning, not getting home till 8 at night and all the rest of it. But anyway, I digress. And I'd like to digress a wee bit further, if that's okay, guys, and just indulge me. And that's probably a bit of a shallow question, but in terms of days, you know, we very often have these international memorial days, including one just a few days ago, the Workers' International Memorial Day, when workers who have been killed in the course of their work are remembered. And then, of course, there is the whole May Day rally thing, which I had the pleasure of attending a few myself during visits to London, including one, I think the last one was 2018, along with Carla and a few comrades from Manchester branch, which was a very interesting day out. But I suppose the question I'm really getting to both you guys and any other comrades is do you think that these particular events, these celebrations, these remembrances are purely symbolic? You know, do you think they have any relevance, or you know, do you think they are, dare I say it, just a waste of time? That's really it in a nutshell. It would be interesting to hear your take on that, if it's not too mundane. Thanks, guys. Cheers.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, gentlemen, would you like to respond?
On hold.
No, I was just going to say that they probably don't serve. I suppose they serve a similar purpose to elections, that they allow us a period of time. It's only a short period in this case. I'm sorry about the cat meowing in the background, by the way. I can't do anything about that. They give people sort of pause to think about things that otherwise they might not think about. I mean, whether it we stand in elections because, you know, at that particular moment, people are or should be interested in politics and are more likely to listen to what we've got to say than in normal everyday circumstances. So I think they're useful in that respect. I mean, they're not that useful, to be honest. I don't think there's any evidence that are sort of having these May Day platforms, which we've often had outdoors in the past, have brought us sort of, you know, extra support or more members. They're probably better for us, you know, for us to be able to sort of, you know, put the case in a public forum than for people who, you know, who aren't socialists. This is supposed to be a May Day rally, and in your average May Day rally, people would be shouting, screaming, and heckling. We've not got that here. Well, all right, we couldn't expect it, I suppose. But to a certain extent, here now, we are talking to ourselves, really, than to other members of the working class. But okay, it's better to do that than to do nothing. But as a direct answer to what Paul says, well, okay, some small use, I suppose. But I don't think we should sort of overestimate the value.
Well, I just
did that cover it?
it's an excuse to have a conversation. And if it's an excuse to, you know, everyone put on their Sunday best and go out for a march, as was, then that there's no harm in that. And, you know, if people, I mean, the whole point, as Howard said, you know, the whole point of what we're doing is when we ask people to vote for us, we're saying, no, you're not voting for us. For us to do something, you're selling other people what you want. It's a way of expressing. We won't make the change unless other people realise that other people want socialism. As long as people are going around thinking, well, I'd love this, but no one else wants it, then of course nothing's going to happen. So that's the kind of like the baseline for propaganda for us. And just as a way of you know, ritual creates identity. And you know, if people are coming along and joining in May Day marches, and they say, "Well, this is the May Day march. This is the world. This is the workers of the world marching together on the same day. This is our day, the world over." I think that's quite a powerful statement of intent. But obviously, you know, it needs to be loud and it needs to be visible.
Brilliant. I really appreciate those soundings and those thoughts. It's one I'd certainly really and share. They're definitely better to be there than not. So yeah, thanks for that. It's good to hear. Cheers, guys. Cheers.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Freddie, please, next.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Before I ask the sort of question, I'd just like to comment in two parts. The contribution that Darren made a bit earlier on there, if I've not misunderstood him, his Glasgow accent's disappearing, it's becoming more American. But anyway, that's just a joke, by the way, Darren. That it's supposed to be a joke. Is that, you know, I think sometimes we're getting a bit pessimistic, I think, on occasions. As to how the case for socialism, etc., maybe not precisely as we advance it, etc., but how people's thinking is becoming more and more aware. And I refer in particular to places, as I've mentioned before, in Africa, that historically, you know, we didn't have known comrades in Africa. And I'd also like to mention the part that Steve mentioned in relation to the capitalism encroaching on us. And my question is primarily based for you, Bill. And I hope I've not misunderstood you. There was a few occasions I couldn't just hear clearly what was being said. But when you were talking about, you know, the sort of, I think it was in effect you're talking about the sort of contractual hours of workers. I recall that there was a survey, I think it was the TUC did it about 2 or 3 years ago, which they periodically do, that just say for discussion's sake, somebody's contracted to 40 hours a week, right? In effect, you know, some of them are working 7, 8, 9 hours a week, more than that, and not getting paid for those hours, because it was a sort of, I better be present here approach to their employment. But of course, you know, when you get workers doing that, it's turning into billions of hours. It really does turn into billions of hours a year where workers are not getting paid. So your reference to the working day is actually, I think, beyond what some of us imagine, that there's so many workers are doing hours in excess and unpaid hours in excess of what they're actually contracted to. Have any more comment on that?
Well, I think yes, certainly. That's a good point. I wish I'd thought to insert it myself, really. I think remember years ago that there've been surveys about just how much time of voluntary time. I mean, even if we exclude, you know, the amount of time people work above and beyond their contracted hours, you know, just voluntary workers, people working beyond. If we went on a universal work to rule, and people turned around and said, right, we're all Thatcherites now, we won't do a penny, a moment's work unless we're paid for it precisely in terms of our contract, the whole system would fall apart fairly quickly. It does depend on us working above and beyond and working as directed. And of course, you know, in some cases, people are working longer hours because, you know, they're not just that they feel they have to, but they've been conditioned to think, well, I've got to do the job properly. It's unprofessional to clock off at the stroke of 5:30. and this sort of thing. So, and I think in some people's cases, because they genuinely, you know, they actually might like their job and want to do it well. I think there is, you know, capitalism does very well off that particular mindset. The struggle of over the working day, yes, isn't just about the formal contracted hours. It's about shaping reality, the reality of the workplace, and that's something that goes on in micro struggles, I suppose you could call it, or every day in every workplace.
Okay, thanks, Bill. Can
I just come back and ask you if you don't
mind? Please do.
I tell you all, and it's not contradicting anything that was said. Whilst Bill was talking, I actually looked up unpaid hours, and I came across the report I remember from a few years back, and it says UK employers claimed 35 billion of free labour last year because of workers doing unpaid overtime. It goes on a bit. I'll finish in just 10 seconds. More than 5 million people put an average of 7.6 hours a week in unpaid overtime during 2019. And the point I'm getting at is that in addition to what they're not already getting paid through their exploitation, they're even getting less on top of that. Thanks for allowing me.
If you could put that on the useful link, Freddie, I'm sure that'd be interesting to people.
If I knew how to do it, Steve, I would.
Send me a message and I'll do it for you. Doogie McClellan, please.
I am. I mean, I work as a volunteer in the Oxfam shop. Obviously, I don't get paid for it. There's a lot of volunteers. And it's quite a happy place to work, really, you know. And we go in when we're supposed to, or we get cover and somebody, you do work another time thing. But the unpaid work that people do when they're in a job, I was talking to, I did a PhD in polymer chemistry, and there was a Japanese guy came over or whatever, and he was surprised that we don't do more unpaid hours or whatever, you know, because it's a policy in Japan not to take holidays and to work very hard. So it's probably worse than other countries in the world. But there is an awful lot of people that volunteer in charity shops. I mean, Lancaster's full of charity shops, and I'm sure most of the people that work in them are volunteers or whatever. And it goes with food banks and things like that, and stuff that's been going on with the pandemic and with the recessions and stuff. So there's a lot of volunteers work that goes unpaid, yeah.
Thanks.
Can I say a word, Steve?
Yeah, please.
Some of the things that have been said in the last few minutes underline the difficulty of answering Darren's earlier question, you know, are things better or worse, etc. Because Darren's absolutely right. I mean, it's a big advantage and possibly a big step forward that we're now freely able to talk about capitalism, to use the word, people more or less know what it means, etc. You know, we don't look sort of like lunatics or anything, as I always felt we did, before the mid-90s when it started to become common. That's obviously a good thing. That's an advantage. But on the other hand, the fact that workers have in recent years found it more and more difficult to resist the encroachments of their employer, the encroachments of capital, and are doing unpaid hours they would never have done in the past. You know, very often contracts these days say that you work, say, 35 hours, and there's a clause which says something like, except where the role demands it. In other words, you know, you can be asked to work more at virtually any time, and many people do. And as I think Freddie said, even when overtime is paid, and it is sometimes, but rarely, even when overtime is paid, it's not paid at the sort of time and a half or double time it used to be paid in the past. So certainly in that way, things seem to have gone backwards. Whether that's sort of significant in terms of people's consciousness, I mean, that's sort of trade union consciousness, really, isn't it? Whether it means that, you know, the far more radical idea we're putting forward has, you know, has sort of stopped advancing, it's very hard to know, because, you know, there are certain things that point in, you know, in the other direction. You know, the fact that we're able to talk about capitalism freely, and you know, lots and lots of people, even if they're not quite on our wavelength, are proclaim themselves anti-capitalists and say they want to do away with exploitation and so on and so forth.
Thanks. If I could just possibly bring a couple of threads together. When we're talking about length of working day, I've seen something about the Chinese, this wonderful so-called communist society, the state capitalist society, and they're talking about people need have a duty to work. Is it 12 hours or 6 hours in? Is it 12-6? I think that's the type of slogan that they're using these days. So maybe that this international competition from the Chinese state capitalist class is affecting the UK. And certainly, okay, I'll leave it at that. So take Joy next, please.
Oh, hi, thanks. I just wanted to ask Howard what he thinks. I mean, we used to think that in an advanced technological society, people would have much more free time. But it strikes me, especially now that we've had this lockdown and working from home, that what technology has actually done is forced human beings to work longer and longer hours because they can. And you know, I can remember in the olden days when we worked in the university, before computers, we used to have the senior common room, we'd go and have lunch and, you know, we'd knock off at 5 o'clock and go home. And now you knock off at 5 o'clock, you go home, you start working again at 7 till midnight. I just wondered what you thought about the advancement of technology.
Yeah. That's another dimension, isn't it, of things? Yeah, that's you know, that's a very good point. Yes, you know, people talk about automation actually doing away with work. In many cases, what it seems to do is to increase the amount of work that people do, because they sort of can do it. They can do it at home and so on if necessary, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, that's, you know, that's a way in which automation isn't actually making less work, but you know, increasing the amount of work that people do. So, you know, that sort of, you know, weighs in the balance on the other side of things, I suppose.
And likewise for me, I mean, you know, a year or so ago, I would have died in a ditch to, you know, not answer an email outside of working hours. But now I'm trapped behind my laptop 7 hours a day. Then I'm watching it in the evening and just opening the emails and just having a quick look at 8:30 in the evening. Oh, what harm is there? It's a hard thing to resist. And I know that's why in France they passed a law to stop that, or to try and stop that kind of encroachment into everyday life, because, you know, everyone's constantly available all the time and therefore technically always on.
if I might just chuck a personal With the internationalisation of production, and partly down to technology, the industry that I work in now is open 24 hours a day, so that I can I'm self-employed, and I can receive let's say job alerts at 7 in the morning, or 6 o'clock at night, you know. So it's one of these things that it's extended my work, potentially expanded my working day. And, you know, rather than relaxing and just watching the football, I'm thinking about this. So, okay. So, Richard, come in a bottle, please.
Just two little comments, really. One was that I think with technology, you know, why things haven't turned out as was predicted in my youth and childhood about, you know, technology would give us more leisure time. The term you hear is the paradox of efficiency. That's it, the paradox of efficiency, the fact that technology means you can do more, then there are more expectations. Even the simple matter of when, you know, when I started work in the late 70s, we didn't have word processors, so I'd be writing a document and it would go off to the typing pool to be typed up. Now the expectation is I would type it myself. You know, it's a computer file. It gets instantly distributed instead of you give it to someone and they send a telex and fax and all this sort of thing. So there's an expectation that more work can be done in the time. The other thing really was that what I personally have done, what I've found since starting to work from home, every day, I used to do it occasionally, but for over a year now I've been working from home. So I've got a equipment set up for working from home in a spare bedroom, and I go in there and I work for my contractual hours, and then I switch off and I shut the door. And that's, you know, I've got that mental discipline of actually I've worked the hours that I'm expected to do. And I tell my boss when I'm going to log off and when you will hear from me again. And I've found that the opposite of what other people have said is that the working from home without anyone physically breathing down your neck has made me able to avoid any unpaid overtime. I think it's the mindset. I know that I've got colleagues, especially much younger colleagues, who just won't do that. They just become workaholics. They're sort of expecting to, you know, it's a sort of professionalism thing that they haven't done. They don't feel they've done enough, you know. I'm 63. I'm too old for that, really. I just go by the rules. I'm in the union, and I feel that they can't get me. That's all. Thanks.
I think you've said it all with that, Richard. You can stuff them because you've only got a couple of years left. But these younger people who probably are on different employment contracts to you, by the way, they're faced with these issues a bit stiffer for them.
You can't get me. I'm part of the union, which was a profoundly anti-union song, by the way. But it seems to apply here. I love what you say, Richard. The paradox of efficiency. Yes, very good indeed. Yeah, that sums up excellently what's going on in so many areas of work at the moment. Resist it. Yeah, if you can. Well done.
Just one observation to bring it back to Karl Marx. He talks about this in the introduction of machinery is not going to liberate the worker from the drudgery of labour. In fact, it's going to make it worse. And I think this is played out every day. I think you're seeing it more and more. What a prescient fella. I think Mike Foster might want to make a comment. No, maybe not. Oh, yes. Okay, go ahead and please, Mike.
Just to follow on from what's just been said about how technology sort of creates more expectations, and of course, you know, email's a big part of that. And I think email sort of spread exponentially or sort of, well, virally, I suppose, don't they? In that if you've got a particular work email, then, you know, it might have half a dozen or more people copied into it. And then, of course, you get into your inbox, you know, half a dozen people's replies, and you have to take all that into account and weigh it all up. And then, you know, other emails fire in as well about something else. I probably get about, 30, 40 work emails a day, maybe. And that sort of contributes to me doing far too much unpaid overtime. But, you know, it's created by the demands of the job. But yeah, I think email, you know, obviously that in the last 20 years or so, that's become a much bigger part of people's working day. And that, although it speeds up communication, of course, that means you can cram in more communication within a day rather than, you know, waiting for a reply to a letter sent by snail mail. You know, everything's much faster these days thanks to email, which has got its good sides, but of course it ups the workload because you just get dumped with more and more emails. That's more things to plough through. Anyway, rant over. Yeah, thank you.
I'll just add that there was actually a discussion at a meeting I was in today that they're going to have to try and look at policies for constraining online collaboration tools, because you've got so much instant communication, people are drowning in it. And you know, they joined up with all these little groups that they can, and they just end up with just endless numbers of alerts and notices that there's someone made a comment somewhere and that they want to join in with it. I mean, one thing I'll add is that actually online meetings actually have made life a little bit easy, because suddenly meetings are all very short, or much shorter, because you don't have that 5 minutes of waiting around for people, walking over there and all this sort of thing. You have the meeting, it finishes and everyone hangs up and then gets back to work at their desk. I suppose from an employer's point of view, that's even more brilliant. But those of us who hate meetings, it's a minor blessing.
Okay. I think probably Brian Johnson hates me, but I'll invite him to speak next. Comrade Johnson.
Yeah, just 2 points. First point is on the actual working day, and the second point is on the actual May Day. The first point, quite recently, British Gas Workers, they took industrial action because of the change in contract. Now, with British Gas, they got two different teams. They got the electrical team, service team, and they got the gas team. Now, the electrical team have always been on a salary rate, whereas the gas team, because they came originally under construction, etc., right, they was on a hourly rate, and consequently got paid for all their overtime, whereas the electrical team, they never got paid for any overtime, but because you get very few emergencies with the electrics, right, they were very rarely called out. Whereas with gas, right, there could be, you know, quite a few emergencies, especially on weekends, and they was called out, and then they were paid because they were called out, and they might only work a couple of hours, right, and fix the emergency. They nevertheless, because under their contract, nevertheless, they got paid for the whole shift at double time or treble time or double time in the day in lieu, whatever it was at that. Now, under the new contract, they've been put on a salary rate, which means they're not going to get paid for any time that they called out on weekend or even in the week, perhaps, you know. They might be called out for an emergency. It just goes to show, you know, they tried the industrial action, it didn't work, and it just goes to show that the amount of muscle that workers got is very little, in fact. Now, my second point in regards to the actual May Day. In my opinion, the present May Day formally, right, is an actual fact, a compromise between the trade union movement and the capitalist class, right? Before we had the official May Day declared as a bank holiday, May Day fell, like it always do, you know, wherever it fell in the week, right? That's when the workers, not generally, but quite a significant majority of them, right, dumped tools and took to celebrating May Day. Once May Day became a bank holiday, that means that celebrations take place, say, of the month in May, right? And the workers, but being wise, you know, they want that celebration to be a bank holiday. So what they do the celebrations the Saturday before, which is tomorrow, right? You know, that's when they'll be doing the marches, giving their speeches, etc., etc., and so forth, right? And consequently, they've given away the disruption value of the actual May Day, right? And it was a significant disruption. And that's why Wilson, in his wisdom, in the 60s, turned around and introduced May Day as a bank holiday. So it brought some order to the business because the disruption was proved to be, you know, quite horrendous for some businesses, etc. That's my little bit.
Thanks, Brian. Comrade Buick?
Yeah, just to follow up what Brian has said, I personally have never worked in all of my working life on the 1st of May, well, partly because I was working for a trade union and partly because I was working abroad. But as I say, even when I was working for a private employer, I never worked on the 1st of the 1st of May. So can I have a medal?
We'll get one struck this week on the 3rd of May.
Definitely, Adam. Yeah. Can I just say interesting stuff from Brian about the history of May Day and the part Harold Wilson played in sort of, to a certain extent, neutralising it. Yeah, very interesting that. Just to go to Brian's other point about the way in which the fact that British gas workers, those who were working in the electrical part of it, have now become salaried staff, and therefore they don't get their overtime anymore. And that as an example of the sort
no,
of
no, the, no, no, you're wrong there, Howard. It's the gas workers.
Other way around, sorry, Brian. Gas, Other way around. But that as an example of the sort of lack of muscle of the trade unions and of workers. I mean, it does seem to show that, but why do they lack muscle? They lack muscle to a certain extent because not enough of them are prepared to take action as and when necessary. But they also lack muscle because the working class as a whole is divided. They know they're not going to have wider support among other workers. Other workers are going to regard them as disruptors in a way that was less common in the past. So that's a sort of negative point, really, in terms of, you know, the development of working class consciousness, I suppose. The fact that the working class are so divided amongst themselves that, you know, even when people go on strike, they can be fairly sure they're not going to get wider support for the strike, even among workers who themselves might, you know, in their own employment go on strike, given the circumstances. So, that's something which has got to be regarded as a negative in terms of how capitalism is putting pressure on workers.
Okay, thanks. I'm getting a bit lost. Is it Richard next? Richard Botterill, I think.
Yeah, just a little thing, nitpicking really, but I just wondered about when the May Day holiday started, and I had a feeling it was 1978. So yeah, Jim Callaghan maybe and Len Murray to thank for that. And that's what Wikipedia says. But it doesn't detract from Brian's point that this is typical of how the trade union leaders stitch up the workers and the Labour government. And he's, you know, so they're stopping the disruption by giving us a public holiday. And Wikipedia also says about plans. Parliament to move the holiday to the autumn, possibly have October the 21st, Trafalgar Day. Oh, how awful. We'll call it a United Kingdom Day. Attempts were made by the John Major government in 1993 to do that, which would have been awful. But on the other hand, it'd be May Day in the Southern Hemisphere, because surely they should have a November Day, shouldn't they, in the Southern Hemisphere for the coming of spring. Oh, well, that's all for me. Just a bit of nonsense, really, for a Friday evening. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Conrad. Darren's withdrawn. I'll take Freddie next, please.
Yeah, only a few seconds. Just an observation, more than a question. But the point that's getting made out, I would agree that the trade union movement has in part lost a lot of influence in recent years. But this question of neutralising them, when we're talking about, it depends what's part of industry or what's part of capitalism. You're talking about, I mean, if you look at, for example, in the power stations, I recall certainly during the miners' strike that the electricians in there were getting paid handsomely and were getting promised pay increases and got pay increases for not coming out on strike, which is one of the reasons why I feel that these days you don't get the power stations, because in that particular area they're well organised. It certainly used to be the case. That unless you were actually in a union, at one time, we know that it was outlawed to a large extent, but at one time, unless you were in a union, you weren't allowed on the power station. So certainly I think it depends as to which industry you're in, is just how influential the unions are. Thank you.
Okay, Freddie, thanks. I think you want to come back in, do you, Darren?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just a reply to point, because it was me that used the word neutralise in the comment. I mean, I really liked the comment that Brian said. I think why I feel it was neutralised is because, you know, Richard mentioned May Day was 78. If I understand rightly, 78, 79 was the high point for union membership in Britain as a percentage of the population. And obviously, you know, if you're old enough, you can, you know, I'm not, but, you know, the beer and sandwiches jokes about Scanlon and Jones, people like that going into, you know, 10 Downing Street to discuss matters. And I think that's what I mean by neutralised. The trade union leadership, who admittedly were just a reflection of the class consciousness of the membership, they thought they had a seat at the table. You know, they thought that they were always going to be there. They thought cooperation, flexing the muscles a wee bit occasionally, but cooperation with capital, you know, things could get sorted a bit, you know, give and take. And obviously capitalism done a number on them, you know, and obviously this doesn't happen overnight and it doesn't happen blanket across all industries, all parts of the country, but, you know, the writing was on the wall, you know, and I think kind of, you know, maybe I'm just like this SPGB loyalist, but you read the standards, like, just from day one, and they kind of warned against this. They warned against a leadership thinking that they could somehow go toe-to-toe with the capitalist class in terms of, like, agreeing and sort of cooperating. And, you know, sadly, you know, the party was vindicated. You know, seemingly at the union trade union movement in Britain's highest point in the late 70s was, if you like, the beginning of the end in some regards. So, yeah, but again, I really like Brian's point about how something that arose out of, like, class struggle, self-activity of the, you know, working class was co-opted so easily, and as a consequence, you know, people just don't understand the historical significance and the importance of May Day today for workers. Thank you.
If I could just follow up on that. Cool. I mean, I think I did try and touch on this slightly. I mean, I kind of phrased it as, you know, May Day was bringing up the official trade union movement. Just to say, it's not just, you know, just some sort of weird decline in the union power. I mean, there is this perpetual structural unemployment that's been there since the 1970s, and that was actually deliberately created. And it's actually quite hard to find out the numbers of absolute number of people who are unemployed. It says it's about at 4.9%, with economic activity at about inactivity at about 20%. So there's still and of course I touched on is the amount of underemployment as well. So that's the structural unemployment is higher than we think. That's what makes the labour market and the official unions particularly weak. I think both here and in the US, which is why people might look to the state, and the employers will look to the state, because obviously, from another perspective, they need to ensure a level playing field among each other. So those employers, those capitalists like Uber and Airbnb and some of these other gig economy firms are undercutting quite dramatically other people, and then they will see that they need to bring them into the regulatory space to make sure that they don't destroy the labour market with their practices. And of course, you know, if you are a gig economy worker, you know, what prospect of being able to turn around and say, well, you know, May Day is ours. I can't, you know, if you can't afford to take some time off from racing your moped around London.
Okay, thank you very much. Right, we've not got any more we've not got any more in speaking. So as it's 9:10, I wonder if I could invite Bill or Howard to summarise if you'd like as a wind up. Assuming that nobody else wants to make a contribution. If you'd like to contribute and you've not contributed, or even if you have, please do so now. Otherwise, I'll ask our speakers to wind up for us. Okay, either Bill or Howard, please.
I wasn't planning to sum up, Steve, but I will make a point following on from what Bill has just said, which I think is sort of relevant to a lot of the discussion that's taken place tonight, i.e. discussion about the role and strength of trade unions. And that is to say, look, it's all in Marx, really, isn't it? The more you've got fuller employment, the more difficult it is for employers to resist workers. The more you've got a lot of unemployment, the easier it is for employers to impose their will upon workers. And Bill's absolutely right. I mean, regardless of the fact that, you know, the official figures show a relatively small degree of unemployment, there's actually a much bigger degree, because a lot of people are underemployed, for example. A lot of people would like more work and can't get it. And a lot of people who are unemployed don't appear for various reasons on the unemployment figures. So, the fact of the matter is that workers are, to a large extent, in the position they're in because they've got very little bargaining power, because capitalism is sort of, it's suffering a sort of ongoing slump, if you like. Now, and things may change in the future. You know, workers may be needed more than they are now. There may be more jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, it will be easier for trade unions or for workers collectively to actually bargain bargain effectively with employers in a way they find it much more difficult to do today. That's all I want to say, really. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks very much, Howard. Bill, I'll take it that you don't want to say anything. So if that's okay with everybody, I'll thank on your behalf the speakers for their efforts, and thank you all for attending, and I wish you all good night, and take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's everyone. Good night, folks.
Yeah, thanks, man. Here's
everyone.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.